Thank you so much, Felix. And thank you, Bernd, for putting together what has been an extraordinary program. It is such a pleasure to be here. My name is Kate Crawford. I am the co-founder and director of the AI Now Institute at New York University. And I'm standing here with Trevor Paglen, who is many things, but he is also an artist fellow with us at AI Now. And Trevor and I have been collaborating on an exhibition about AI and images, which is going to be opening at the Fondazione Prada later this year. And this project has involved us looking at hundreds of training data sets, and I would say by this point, thousands and thousands of images. So it's quickly for us turned into this much deeper dive into the nature of images themselves. So today, we're going to talk about the way that images are used in AI. We're interested in three questions in particular. First, what is an image for the purposes of artificial intelligence? And what work do images do in AI systems? And finally, what is at stake in how AI systems are harvesting, labeling, and deploying images in the world? So I'm going to begin with a little story about machine vision from its early origins back in the mid-20th century. In 1966, Marvin Minsky at MIT decided that interpreting images was central to the idea of machine intelligence. But given that vision is something that many creatures can do, squirrels, fish, birds, he assumed that this would be a relatively straightforward task. So he asks his undergraduate student at the time, Joel J. Sussman, to spend the summer linking a camera to a computer and getting the computer to describe what it sees. This becomes the Summer Vision Project. And needless to say, it probably won't surprise you that the process of getting computers to describe objects in the world took a little bit longer than one summer. The current narrative, of course, is that we've come so far with contemporary AI that challenges such as object recognition and facial recognition have now been solved. But we would argue that actually the opposite is true. The challenge of images and what they mean will always be far more political than a technical issue. Once labels are applied to images, a type of meaning has been constructed at the level of representation and identity. And this can have profound consequences for how we understand the world and understand ourselves. Of course, just ask 6% black Michael Jackson here. Now, we may also bring particular interpretations to an image like this from the Baton Rouge protest over the shooting of Alton Sterling by police officers. But if you run this image through an AI image recognition system, like the caption bot, it'll be interpreted a little bit differently. It says, this is a group of people standing around in a parking lot. Well, this is obviously a pretty clear example of vision systems being unable to read context, and thus profoundly missing the many layered meanings of this image. But there are more subtle problems with images, labels, and AI that are going on around us all the time. So have a look at this image here. This comes from a film that Trevor made last year based on a string quartet, and then he used an off-the-shelf AI recognition algorithm. This is basically doing exactly what Marvin Minsky would have hoped for his summer project. The computer is describing what it sees in real time. But what does it mean that the system is describing this person as a woman, or that she's likely 0 to 12 years old, or that the emotion she's feeling is 49% sad? What is the work done by these forms of recognition and misrecognition? Basically, what is it to describe an image? As soon as we begin talking about the meaning of images, we are also talking about politics. The nature of images has historically been at the heart of struggles over power. We can, of course, go back to 8th century Byzantium, where the controversies over making images of Christ resulted in the mass destruction of images, or the so-called iconoclasm of 726 AD. And this struggle over images and meaning persists in the modern era. When Magritte said, "This is not an apple," he is pointing out that, to one extent or another, the relationship between images and meaning is arbitrary and ultimately subject to political operations. But if an AI system is, say, inspecting fruit quality, and it looks at the Magritte and says, "No, actually, this is an apple. It's a red and green apple, definitely," then what's going on here? Well, we're in a contest of meaning. And who gets to decide what images mean is fundamentally about the root of power and hierarchy. So tonight, we're going to open up the question of images, AI, and power. In particular, we're interested in how this happens in the subset of AI known as machine learning, which has risen to become the dominant form in the last decade. And forgive me, I'm going to give you a short definition. Because machine learning systems use algorithms and statistical models to automate the performance of discrete tasks like recognizing faces, filtering your email, or directing Felix's autonomous vehicle going down the stairs. Machine learning works by building a mathematical model of sample data, which is called training data. And the system uses this to make predictions or decisions. And we want to show you some of this tonight. Because for these systems to recognize images, they have to be trained on thousands, sometimes millions, of discrete images. So in short, images have become the lingua franca of machine learning. They are the underlying alphabet from which vision systems are detecting forms and making meaning. Now, we probably don't think of AI as a practice of doing things with images, but perhaps we should. Because right now, AI systems are making fundamental interventions into visual culture, ones that have far-reaching consequences that may go even further than the invention of photography in the 19th century, and even perhaps the invention of perspective in the 15th century. Because if we go back to when Alberti outlined the idea of artificial perspective in 1435, it was rapidly and widely accepted across Western Europe to be an infallible method of representation. Basically what W.J.T. Mitchell calls an automatic and mechanical production of truths about the material and mental worlds. Definitely sounds familiar to some of the things we read about AI. But this was a profound transformation. At the same time, it was denying its own artificiality by laying claim to being just a natural representation of how things really look. Then the invention of the camera just reinforced this idea that perspective is the natural way of seeing. So just as perspective and photography completely transformed our understanding of vision and images in ways that we now completely accept, so the advent of AI is altering some of these basic relationships between humans and images under the banner of science and objectivity. As Mitchell likes to joke, ultimately what is natural is evidently what we can build a machine to do for us. So in order to understand the deeply political interventions going on right now, we first have to understand the model of vision that underlines AI systems. So we are going to take you into that strange underlayer of logic that guides how images are being harvested, recognized, and labeled in AI. And we're going to end by suggesting to you that images are no longer spectacles that we observe, but they are in fact looking back at us. Images are actors in a process of massive value extraction drawn from the most minute and intimate elements of everyday life. And on that, I'm going to pass to Trevor.
Thank you so much, Kate. So this is a kind of map of our talk. First, Kate mentioned that we've been spending a lot of time looking at training sets, looking at libraries of images that are used to teach autonomous vision systems how to see, as it were. We've been looking at that and looking at some of the underlying politics that are built into these training libraries. Training libraries, in a way, create a kind of vocabulary and grammar of seeing. And this happens at many different levels. When we look at precedents to contemporary AI training libraries, we find things like the great 19th century phrenologists, Galton, early biometrics, databases of fingerprints used by law enforcement. But in the 1990s, we see the beginning of like real training libraries built for computer vision systems. One early set that these images are taken from was created by the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects, in the early 1990s. This is a data set called Ferret, which consists of thousands of images of people's faces. And it was used to encourage research in early facial recognition. It was meant to be a kind of benchmark that different laboratories could use to test their facial recognition systems against and the performance of their algorithms. Another early training set is this one called MNIST. This was used to teach computers how to read handwritten numbers. Now, if we fast forward to contemporary training sets, we can start to see the kinds of assumptions and even forms of power that are built into them. When we're looking at training images, we're looking at taxonomies, we're looking at categories, we're looking at labels, we're looking at relationships between images and concepts. This is an example of that. This is an excerpt from a database used to train computers how to recognize affects and emotions. This one is from 1998. It's called JAFFE, which stands for Japanese Female Facial Expressions. It's 213 images of these women making 7 facial expressions. That same year, this data set was released as well. This one is called Karolinska Directed Emotional Faces, or KDEF. And this consists of 70 individuals, each displaying those same emotions: happiness, sadness, fear, disgust, anger, surprise, and neutral. So here, in the case of these data sets that are intended to teach machines how to recognize people's affects, we have a bunch of assumptions built into them in the first place. First assumption, the idea that emotions is a sensible taxonomy in the first place. Second assumption, there are only 6 emotions plus neutral. Really? Third assumption, emotions are somehow expressed on people's faces. Right? So where do these assumptions come from? Well, the underlying paradigm of this taxonomy comes from the work of a specific psychologist, a guy named Paul Ekman. And Ekman asserted that emotions can be reduced and categorized into 6 basic universal categories that can be ascertained by looking at somebody's face. The eyes provide the proverbial window to the soul. And although Ekman's work has been profoundly critiqued by psychologists and anthropologists and people like Kate, who found that this work simply does not hold up to sustained scrutiny, this paradigm has nonetheless become adopted by AI researchers and developers. In a way, this kind of makes sense. Ekman's paradigm is actually perfect for AI because it assumes a transparent relationship between appearance and essence, and it also assumes a series of discrete and universal categorizations. And this almost phrenological will is the stuff that AI is largely made out of. We can see these politics of taxonomies even more clearly in places like this. These are excerpts from a data set called the UTK Face Data Set, which consists of over 20,000 images of faces, and it has annotations for age, gender, race, and ethnicity. And let's look at the taxonomies here. In the description, age is an integer from 0 to 116, indicating the age. Gender is either 0, male, or 1, female. Race is an integer from 0 to 4, denoting black, white, Asian, Indian, and others, like miscellaneous. So again, we can quite clearly see that there is a politics to the taxonomy itself.
Gender is binary, one or a zero. Race can be encapsulated by four categories: white, black, Asian, Indian, and miscellaneous. And the racial categories of this data set recall previous racial classifications from the past, in particular one used by the South African apartheid regime in the 1970s, where each person was legally classified as black, white, colored, or Indian. Other data sets recapitulate the kind of obsession of the face of the criminal that has been so much the bread and butter of phrenology since the 19th century. These photographs here are excerpts from an American National Institute of Standards training set, one that's called NIST Special Database Number 18. And this data set consists of mugshots of 1,573 people who have been arrested multiple times. So the training set has pictures of them over different times that they were arrested. And the training set is meant to be used to help track how faces age over time. Now, a huge milestone in the development of training sets takes place in 2009, when computer vision researchers at Stanford and at Princeton release one of really what has become one of the gold standards of publicly available training sets. This is a data set called ImageNet. And ImageNet consists of over 14 million images that are labeled by hand into more than 20,000 categories. It's massive and it's intricate. And ImageNet is a major development for a couple of reasons, having to do a lot with how it was made. On one hand, there's a couple of things that are new here. On one hand, the ability to collect tens of millions of images in the first place. And on the second hand, the ability to label tens of millions of images. And what made this possible? Well, of course, on one hand, this is made possible by this centralization of data and indexing in places like Google, Amazon, at the time Flickr. So these platforms made it possible to collect images at this scale. But there's another aspect to it which is just as important, if not more, which is that those very same platforms allowed the creation of a kind of backbone of piecemeal labor practices. ImageNet was created by employing Amazon Turk workers to label those millions of images that the researchers had to collect and to organize them into categories. The point here is that when we're talking about the politics of training data, those politics are just as much infrastructural as they are epistemological, or as much as they are about the power to create forms of common sense. I'll pass it back to you, Kate.
So Trevor's talked a little bit about this sort of meta taxonomy. We're going to go down a level now to the classes themselves that exist in, say, ImageNet. So the question here is, what kinds of concepts get reified as classes within ImageNet? So, you know, a class like Apple might seem relatively uncontroversial, but when you're dealing with data sets that have tens of thousands of classes, they get very relational and very weird very quickly. They move from being descriptions to being judgments. Now, this is an example of an image that was taken during Mark Zuckerberg's hearings in Congress last year. And here we've just applied an open source neural network called YOLO 9000, which can recognize around 9,500 different classes of objects. But have a look, because this image actually is very interesting. You'll see that some people are labeled as workers, and down the bottom here, the women who are actually transcribing are labeled as person, but if you look at the guys who have ties up the back, they're leaders. Right. And also, weirdly, I mean, there's also this category of lawgiver, which seems sort of be peppered randomly through the crowd. Now, these are obviously very different sorts of nouns to Apple, and they're bringing this sort of descriptive characterization that I think reveals where ideology has been baked into the system. But let's go further into the ImageNet categories. This is a really charming one called bad person. Here we have debtor, so obviously something in your face can certainly correlate to your bank account. And then this one, swinger and tramp. Right. Clearly, these are heavily laden value judgments at work here. But again, you have to keep in mind that these are images of people, and the people have no idea that their selfies or their photos from their last beach vacation have now been scraped from the internet and are being labeled as examples of a tramp. So that is what's going on at the level of the class. And now let's dive down to the most molecular level, the way individual images are being labeled. So have a guess what this image is. Apparently, this is a sharecropper. Try guessing this one. This is a bit of a tricky one. This is a noticer. Okay, fair enough. This woman is a mute, and this man is an anti-Semite. All right. And Trevor and I couldn't really figure out what is going on in this image. It seems to be an Indigenous child in some distress, but this has simply been labeled as toy. So there's obviously a kind of incredible flattening of meaning and context that is going on here. So when we look back at this overall architecture of a training set, we can see that these levels of taxonomy, class, and image are being presented as essentially an unproblematic, apolitical set of choices. But as you can see, these are highly political moments at each one of these layers. So what happens when a system trained like this is then let loose into the world in order to make sense of it? Trevor is going to tell us.
Well, the basic question here that we're trying to unravel is, how do machines see? How does AI see? How is it trained to see? And then how does it go about seeing? Let's imagine we've trained a neural network on something like ImageNet, and now what it can do is go out and look at the world and say that, oh, you know, this is a woman with long brown hair, what have you. How does it see? Well, the training stage acts as a kind of filter. The training data sorts an infinitely complex world into discrete categories and image types, and the machine vision system can then recognize those categories and image types out in the world. Now, I would argue that this is not actually how machines see. In a limited kind of technical sense, yes, perhaps, but in reality, this is not what's going on. At the end of the day, let's keep in mind, the point of computer vision systems isn't actually to recognize objects. It's to make money. It's to extract value from the collection and interpretation of images. The alphabet here is not about the building blocks of meaning making so much as about the various forms of power being exercised. And me and Kate have started calling this predator vision. And this predator vision of artificial intelligence has several sides. On one side, we see a drive to collect the maximum amount of images and other forms of data to generate profits. And this is done largely without our consent or our knowledge. And this constitutes a kind of enclosure, the kind of everyday spaces and intimate moments of our lives that were previously, you know, very inefficient for capital or police to get into, are now wide open for occupation and extraction. And we're starting to see this in insurance, credit, finance, everyday infrastructures. State Farm Insurance, for example, recently started doing a series of studies to try to classify drivers' behavior using computer vision systems installed in cars to monitor drivers in real time to see if they're distracted, to see if they're texting while driving or engaging in other kinds of risky behavior. And this study is indicative of an overall shift that's happening in the insurance industry, a shift that they describe as moving away from category data towards source data. And the idea here is that your insurance premiums are constantly fluctuating based on the insurance company's real-time assessment of the level of risk of your behaviors. Your auto insurance company, for example, would have sensors installed in your car, and they would watch you drive. Now, if you're texting or distracting, or if it thinks that you look sleepy or distracted or you're speeding, your insurance premium will go up in real time. At the same time, if it likes how you're driving, if you follow the recommended routes that it gives you, it might give you a discount on your insurance for that premium, that period of time. And this is happening across many domains. This is happening across health insurance domains, where insurance companies are monitoring what you eat and how much you exercise, modulating your premiums based on that. Credit card companies assessing risk based on patterns of life and habits. And this world of constant modulation, of constant monitoring, happens within, obviously, a very normative framework. Now, the other side of this predator vision is a kind of colonial ordering, the autonomous assignation of meanings, classifications, and judgments from a top-down perspective, this kind of will to classify as a means of control, all in the name of objectivity. Let's take a company called Predictum. This is an online service that uses advanced artificial intelligence to assess a babysitter's personality. It looks at job candidates of babysitters and then looks at all of their pictures from Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and uses an AI to analyze those pictures to determine their trustworthiness or their risk of being a drug user on a scale of 1 to 5. It takes thousands of images and boils them down to a single digit risk number. The result here is a stark power asymmetry. The employers can look at everything, the low wage worker cannot opt out. And this constitutes another kind of enclosure, an enclosure of meaning-making, where the interpretation of images constitutes an exercise of asymmetrical power. Our built environments are watching us, looking for moments and images to extract value from us. And so many of the assumptions made about human life, made by these systems, are narrow, normative, and laden with error. When we showed the Apple class from ImageNet before, we said that this was probably not a particularly controversial class. But in the kind of logic of predator vision, an apple is actually never an apple. When is an apple a signifier for health or wellness that modulates your insurance policy? When is it a signifier for sin or knowledge or of a high quality saleable piece of produce, and who decides what that is? The meaning of the apple is motivated by the types of value that can be extracted from it and the asymmetrical forms of power that it can reproduce and reinvigorate.
So, in sum, the advent of widespread computer vision and AI is constituting, as Felix said earlier, a new regime of images. Images are no longer categorized by the dynamics of mass media and the spectacle. Instead, they're part of an active apparatus that is being used to extract value from sections of society that were previously pretty inaccessible to capital and the state. We have Alexa in our bedrooms and in our kitchens. We have cameras on our desks, phones, and in our cars, and ultimately, our affects, our attentions, and our histories are being captured. This unrestrained thirst for new fields of cognitive exploitation has driven a search into ever deeper layers of human bodies, human actions, and behaviors. Every single form of biodata, including forensic, biometric, sociometric, and psychometric, is right now being captured and logged for training AI systems. Now, we can kind of think of these spaces that were previously difficult for capital and the state to occupy as having essentially created a type of de facto commons, a commons that gave us a certain kind of freedom through anonymity. And as these systems become more ubiquitous, they colonize more space by subjecting everyday life and bodies to the top-down logics of financial extraction and to these epistemologies of phrenology, classification, and control. And this matters, because deciding what images mean is at the root of power. Every social struggle has included a struggle for meaning as much as a struggle over rights, because these two are actually inseparable. Every social struggle has been, in part, an effort to make images mean different things. Struggles for self-representation are exactly that. Struggles to define the meaning of your image. The freedom to say, this is not an apple, is the freedom to say, I am a man, or I am a woman, or I am neither of these. So our hope is that by opening up the substrate of images, this weird underworld of the visual that is generally unseen, but is nonetheless the fundamental proving ground of all visual AI construction, that we can begin to critically engage with and pull apart some of these claims that AI vision is somehow objective, universal, ahistorical, and non-ideological. Because training data is one level at which we can start to see the historical and cultural origins, labor practices, infrastructures, and epistemological assumptions that are being built into these systems. So our project is to look at how training data is materially constructed and deployed in order to surface what we see as the emerging grammar and political economy of AI. Thank you.